toi qui ne veux rien dire, toi qui me parles.
Sehr geehrte Fahrgäste, willkommen in Salzburg Hauptbahnhof. Ihre nächsten Reisemöglichkeiten.
Termitinitus.org.
Das Pfeff.
Vorsicht, diese Sendung wird abgehört.
I'm into a news collective that is called Omnia TV. It's a, in a way, a grassroots journalism platform. And we follow up on certain issues. We don't do current affairs. We don't do, you know, daily stuff. We focus on certain issues and we try to follow them as much as we can. We focus on the Golden Dawn trial the past 3.5 years. I have a show every Friday night, a webcast that I'm actually analyzing and reporting on what is going on in the Golden Dawn trial week by week. I've published lots of parts from videos and telephone calls and communications between Golden Dawn members that are part of the case file. And in general, I try to reveal a big part of their organization and the way they moved the power ladder up. I know them since, you know, the 80s or 90s. I used to be a more militant when I was younger. I was in the streets scuffling, and, you know, once upon a time we were looking in the streets of Athens to find some Golden Dawner to attack and strip him off and shit like that, because Golden Dawners were actually a very graphic representation of the far right in the past years. But that thing changed by the end of 2008 or 9, and they started to create that organization that we know as Golden Dawn now. Because Golden Dawn exists since the beginning of the 80s.
What is it? What is the origin? Where does it come from, the uprising of the neo-Nazis in Greece?
Well, especially Golden Dawn, which actually now is the main representative of the neo-Nazi and far-right part in Greece, began on the early 80s, 1980, by Nikos Michaloliakos, which is actually the now fear of Golden Dawn. He was a renowned far-right person since the 1976-7 and so on. He began by placing explosive devices in cinemas that were playing Russian movies. He got arrested and he was charged with possessing of explosives. He was not even charged for attempting murder or something, because these explosive devices were put in two different cinemas and they create a huge explosion, and it was by luck, by accident, that we didn't have any dead. He got arrested along with 3 or 4 others. He actually said to the police whom he was with, and he made a bit of a deal. So he was only convicted for 11 months. I can't remember if he even did any jail time.
So, and the others?
The others did something like 12 to 14 months or something like that. He created Golden Dawn by the beginning of 1980. In 1982, he actually made it an organization. And for lots of years, he tried to create battalions to fight in the street with leftists and anarchists. He did that in a smaller scale than the past 10 years. He's really known for actually betraying his number twos and threes. He does that a lot. He did that with his number two at these years, by the end of 80s, beginning of 90s. He had the militant leader for his militants in the street, that his nickname was Periandros. He attacked a student along with 8-10 others back in the 90s. He disappeared after the attack. He surrendered himself 7 years after the attack, and he got tried and convicted and made jail time and so on. He's number one. After that, Mihaloyakos, by the half of the 90s, he actually made an effort to go inside the football scene, the hooligan scene, and the supporters of teams and so on. One of his people helped him a lot. He is now an MP, Ilias Panagiotaros, helped him a lot because Ilias Panagiotaros has a business that creates t-shirts and shit like that. And he was in really close contact with lots of the gates and the chapters of various supporter groups in various teams. In the beginning of the 90s, they took advantage of the Albanian borders opening. And when the Albanians came as economic migrants in Greece, they started the narrative of migration and we don't want the migrants and so on. Their main target were Albanians. It's the same thing now with Syrians and people from sub-Saharan places and migrants and refugees in general. But then we had only the biggest migrants group was from Albania. So in a way, it's the same thing that actually repeats itself 20, 25 years after that. Golden donors were, as I said before, really in that not visible part of society. They were mostly thugs, people that don't have any education, or whatever education they had didn't, you know, actually change anything for them. People that thought and still thinking that Greece is one of a kind, and that, you know, that exceptionalism we sometimes have, that we have 3,000 years of history that was never interrupted, even when we had the Ottomans and so on, you know, historical myths that create a national identity. So yeah, they were into that really, really big time, but they were also into national socialism. We have images and pictures from their offices, from their rallies and so on, with lots of Nazi insignia. Lots of these guys that were then wearing swastikas and so on, now they're MPs. They have swastikas as tattoos, but now they wear suits, which actually is something, you know, it's one part of the history to come, of the history that is going to happen, and we need to understand it. Because now in the far right part of society in Europe, we are in a verge. I really stand by the analysis of Enzo Traverso. He says that we actually are now moving into meta-Nazism, post-Nazism, actually. Because we have Islamophobia. We don't have the neo-Nazi insignia anymore. We don't have the Gothic crosses and shit like that in the rest of Europe. Golden donors are dinosaurs. They are neo-Nazis now. They're not post-Nazis. Kurds, he's a post-Nazi, actually. Because he has that Islamophobia element on his politics platform that he has legitimized in the eyes and the ears of the population. And he is a white-collar guy with his tie, with his bills on hand, with his laws, with his, you know, not going along with even the slightest notion of let's help these people and take them inside and induct them and, you know, let's enrich our societies. It's a chance. He doesn't have that, as Orban doesn't have that, as Salvini doesn't have that. we are in the verge of post-Nazism in Europe. All these guys are mostly white collars. On the other hand, Orban and Kurz are more, are higher in the food chain, in a way, in the class food chain. So yeah, I jumped from one issue to another, but for me that's the analysis that we need to make nowadays to understand the differences and understand where we are heading to.
I think I remember from my childhood when I was in Peloponnese, mm-hmm. I remember there was always this paper, this newspaper actually, which you get in every kiosk and every supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the name Chrissi Avgi.
Oh yeah, they like have a newspaper for 20 years now. Yeah, yeah, it was their official newspaper, their voice of their narrative. Actually, it was a magazine during the 80s that evolved to the newspaper.
But how is it possible? I mean, too many people sell it. I mean, of course, it's good money, maybe, but
especially in Peloponnese. We have a big part of people that are far right, like for ages, for generations, and so on. In Greece, first of all, one thing we say, it was during the 1910 and 1920, which was actually the thing we say as the big division. It was a division between a part of the state and the throne. We used to have a king and so on. That division actually evolved and ended up on the Minor Asia campaign and destruction, actually, as we say it, during the 20s, 1922-23. After that, part of the Greek army created chapters outside the structure of the army, people that fought in Minor Asia and people that were really royalists, created chapters throughout Greece, and these were the people and the groups that dictator Ioannis Metaxas used to establish his dictatorship during 1930s. The division between right and left was then actually established, because it was prior to Metaxas, it was the first time that we had major pogroms and major polarization between the two parts of the spectrum, of the political spectrum. Then comes Second World War. During Second World War, these people that were extremely far right, some of them were really close to Nazis, mostly Peloponnesians and people from northern Greece, Thessaloniki and Kilkis and Xanthi and places like that, that they were actually collaborating with the Germans, and they created battalions after 1943 that were armed by the Germans, that were fed and organized by the Germans to pursue the Revolutionary Army of EAM and communists and dissidents and so on during the war. Okay, these people, these families, most of them survived after the war, and you can track down names and families up to the Junta regime of 1967 to 74. Where I'm going with all that analysis is that we have a part that supports Golden Dawn in Peloponnese and northern Greece that has a historical bind with the far-right narrative, the religion, nation, family narrative. We have a saying, the far-right in Greece has a saying that says nation, religion, and family. These are the three things that we believe in. And that's a part of meta-Nazism, in a way, because especially family, the traditional family, the family that doesn't acknowledges that there are other sexes than male and female, doesn't think that the LGBTQ part of the population is something, you know, humane. For them it's something abnormal and it should not be in our society and so on. That's a major, identity politics is a major part of metanazism. But to go back, we have that line, that historical line that binds the today far right with some major historical events in Greece. So Peloponnese is really dense in far right believers, and that's why you came along the newspaper many times.
So is it like the Chrysi Avgi today, they still fans of the junta, of the dictatorship?
Well, of course they are. They wouldn't change, but they are not expressing it so much. They had their opportunity to express it, and they did it, and also inside the parliament some days ago, that we had the 17th of November, the commemoration of the Politecnio and so on, and they said in the parliament that there were no deaths and no victims in the Politecnio uprising. There was, junta was not so bad after all, and shit like that. They do that. But not in so many occasions as they did prior to the trial. The trial made them to soften up a bit, because they understand that they are in a difficult position and they don't want to create circumstances that would put them in a more difficult position. One part is that, and there's another part that they are, balancing between their past narratives and some newer and more soft image, and that is because they have a core that they know that this core of supporters is fond of violence, is fond of the far-right narrative, is fond of junta, is fond of Nazis, some of them. And these are the people that are going to support them in the next elections. So for them now, it's actually a pre-election rally, whatever they do. So yes, they might have a bit of, soften up, but they maintain a basic narrative in order to appeal in their core supporters.
So after the 90s, it was a bit more silent, and they came with the crisis.
When the crisis came up, it was, as history has shown, it was their chance, their big opportunity, because first of all, they had the opportunity to take advantage of what we say after so many years of crisis, the revenge vote. Lots of people that didn't know or didn't want to know what's going on with Golden Dawn, and they were listening to their speeches and all these prior to 2012 elections, and they were the Golden Dawners were saying that we're going to go into the parliament, we're going to kick everybody out, and we are going to beat them up and shit like that. And for some people, that was a good idea, in a way.
Like for half a million
people. Yeah. It was in a way, part of that half a million, I thought that it was a good idea. There's another part of that half a million that has these relations and that historical connection with them, as I said before. And there is another part that they were mostly young voters that were intrigued by their militant appearance. And also we have CAPs and a small part of the army, much smaller than the CAPs. For the CAPs we are talking about something like, 30-40%. We've seen and we've listened and we've read about CAPs saying about Golden Dawn and talking to people on marches and saying to them that we are Golden Dawners, we're gonna fuck you up and shit like that. We had incidents of anti-fascist marches that were attacked by CAPs yelling Golden Dawn and shit like that. We have incidents of anti-fascist people getting arrested and then tortured in the central building of police administration and things like that. So we can be very confident about the connection between CAPS and Golden Dawn. And also we have lots of evidence on that during the trial. because we have lots of cases that police stations were not receiving, they were refusing to receive charges pressed by migrants after attacks. They were facilitating golden donors and after attacks to migrants and letting them go when the dust was down and things like that. We have such behaviors in the police body these past 10-15 years,
which started with the participation in the government and parliament.
There were some elements that we knew for years, more than 10. But after Golden Dawn got into the parliament, these things were actually legitimized. And it was more easy for them to express, for the cops to express such ideas and such narratives.
And how was the reaction? I mean, to have a neo-Nazi party in the parliament?
You know, for one part of the people that have a relation with history, or, I don't know, have a better approach to history, it was a very tragic situation. Some of the people were saying, and mostly in the center of the political spectrum, they were saying, nah, we ain't gonna have a problem, democracy is strong and shit like that. Some right-wing supporters were, you know, like, we might collaborate in the future, we don't know, or whatever. And that thing was actually happening. In the parliament, in the first parliamentary period of Golden Dawn, evidence have shown that they were in very close contact with the then ruling party, New Democracy. Especially with their number two of New Democracy, the Secretary General of the then government of Antonis Samaras. They were in a very close contact, and he was actually saying to them and giving them, you know, directions when they should be in the parliament to vote for what bill at what time. One part of our society, it wasn't something like new, it wasn't a surprise. We know that part of their supporters have come from New Democracy, because prior to Golden Dawn being in the parliament or taking part in the elections with the hope to be in the parliament, these far right, these people that were thinking and they had far right ideas and so on, were actually voting for years New Democracy. You know, the far right element was inside the party that was appearing as a center right party. So these supporters found out that we have an original far right party now, we don't have to go to New Democracy. We have our own home. That's why it was so easy for so many people to go and vote for Golden Dawn.
So what did they do in the parliament?
In the parliament, they tried to create a political platform that combined anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, attack to the political system, taking advantage of the political system crisis and the Europe's crisis, identity crisis, and so on. They tried to create a network to communicate with various social groups and people from various backgrounds and working class people and people from the public sector, firefighters, fishermen, workers in big industries and so on. They try to, you know, infiltrate there, to create their own labor unions. Mm-hmm. And in general, they try to do stuff to be in the surface of in the mainstream media and so on. They used lots of mainstream media, and the media were very happy to be used to communicate their ideas, to communicate their way of solving issues and problems, and also to communicate some of their actions that were actually a way to be the law without being the law. You know, they went to bazaars and markets, and they were checking migrants for their licenses to sell stuff, or their papers and their permits and shit like that.
So they took away the work from the police.
Yeah, in a
because
way.
They are in the parliament.
Yes, in a way, and that was, you know, for both parts of their audience was good. For the cops was good, because they had lots of hands to do stuff for them and chase down migrants and so on. And for one part of their supporters was like, you know, these guys are hands-on. They're not just talking, and they do stuff. Was the like that.
Professionals.
Yeah, was like that. So, yeah, they tried to create such a platform. They took lots of stuff and political elements from the left in terms of, as I said before, the crisis of the European identity, the crisis of or the so-called crisis of multicultural societies, because there was after the first migration wave on 2012-13, there was a huge conversation about it, but it was a conversation really bigger than the issue, because Europe can, you know, has shown in the past that can actually include and induct millions of people. And it was the way that our modern societies came to life, actually. So, yeah, they took advantage on that of that conversation. And along with some loans from the left narrative of corruption, the way the political system works, the way the monetary system works, and so on, they took some stuff from there. And they tried to create a political platform that used all these elements in order to appeal in various target audiences in the voters' tanks. And that was, they actually did a huge, they put a huge effort on that, especially the first 3 years. That they 1 or 2 years prior to the election and up to the end of 2013. But with the murder of Issas, that thing, you know, crumbled down, because it was obvious after that, even though we had murders of migrants and pogroms and, you know...
But it was one of the first male white guys who died.
Greek white, that was the two major elements. Because we had Sajjad Loughman prior to that. We had other nameless victims. We don't know yet. We have victims that we don't know yet their names. Stabbed people. The Fischer case was the case that turned the page. And we ended up with the trial and so on. But they still try to do that. They still try to take advantage of the platform that they made. Although sometimes they are more, you know, as I said before, they have some parts of their narrative, they have softened them up in a way.
Mm. So what happened in the days after Pavlos Fischer's death?
First of all, a big part of the society was in an uproar. It was an event that shook a lot of people. In the first 24 hours, the major thing took all the attention was the way that the media tried to handle the case. Because the first reports of the mainstream media, although we knew what happened some hours after the attack and the murder, because we knew it through social media and through our own networks, the next morning, we had major shows, morning shows on mainstream media that they were saying that it was about football. There was a killing about football. So if we didn't have all the information through our networks and the people that were actually there and people that were on the spot half an hour after the murder, mainstream media might have actually covered up the case. fortunately, that didn't happen. The Golden Donors were refusing everything. They were saying that we don't know what happened. We don't know the guy that stabbed Fissas. There were no people of our organization there or whatever. But day by day, as the various evidence were published, it was very difficult to say no. We weren't there. So they started another narrative that the guy there was used to be in the Communist Party and got into Golden Dawn to actually provoke and distort us and shit like that. That also wasn't the truth. That was also a lie, because Yorgos Droupakias, that murdered Pavlos Fissas, was actually an official of the local chapter in Nikia of Golden Dawn. So yeah, they tried to put out some false narratives, but nothing worked, actually.
It sounds quite similar now to the things that are happening with the murder of Chuck from the LGBT community.
It's the same thing. The two perpetrators tried to do the same thing along with the cops. The same thing. Like, you know, he came into steal. The owner of the shop wasn't there, and he got he closed himself into the jewelry shop, and then some brave Greeks tried to make a citizen's arrest. It was a stupid thing like that, but the perpetrator unfortunately got hurt by the glasses that broke after the effort of the people that tried to stop him. That was the first narrative in a matter of 15 minutes.
Mm.
Okay? But then the video came out, and a bit of evidence and some witnesses and so on. And we understood in something like one day that everything was a cover-up. And it's more or less the same thing, because the network is the same. The mainstream media, the same mainstream media that were saying that Fissas was killed for football, the same cops were, I say the same, not the same persons, but the same mechanism, the same official body in a way. They were also in the night of the murder of Pavlos Fissas. There were like eight cops present and did nothing. And in Zach's case, they were not like, they didn't only do nothing, they even they might have contributed to his death with the way they tried to arrest him. He was nearly dead, and they tried to put cuffs on him and shit like that, and they put up a show in front of the camera. So yeah, it has a great similarity.
So there is this strong body of fascism in Greece, like,
yes,
the police, the media, Chrissi Avgi, like the neo-Nazi scene.
Yes, and it's really awkward that although we have that strong element of fascism and that interconnecting fascism between all these groups, you can see the polls and you can see the numbers of Golden Dawn. And the numbers cannot go above 7%.
Mm.
Although in other countries, as you know, in Austria we have a government that is completely far right. In Hungary we have the same. In Italy we have the same. We have Frankists coming out of the depths of history in Spain. Like, what the fuck? It's a bit awkward. It's an oxymoron that we have such a strong part of fascists and far-right ideology in Greece, but that thing cannot be translated, cannot be transformed in a ruling power.
Mm-hmm. And that's where we come to the court.
Well, yeah, that's one part. That's one part.
Mm-hmm.
That stopped that, in a way. And there's another part which actually has to do with the society, with the people, with an anti-fascist front that has been created for years now. Because even when Golden Dawn, by the end of 2007-8, was trying to create some certain parts of Athens as their territories, there was a huge front that was trying to stop them. And that front got really empowered after the murder of Pavlos Fissas. So it has to do with the people, it has to do with the movement, it has to do, even though sometimes we nag and we say, oh, we are not organized and we should do more, and sometimes the leftists are really slow in doing stuff, the anarchists are really targetless and without any strategy and shit like that. Even if we nag about all these issues, the movement is strong. The movement is strong. The movement can do stuff out of the blue. Because lots of people understand the necessity and the seriousness of the issue. That's why these percentages are still low. If that movement, if that front collapses, I don't know how all these far-right narratives can, you know, will evolve. Because if you don't have someone in front of you to stop you, you will go on. And when you have all that surrounding influence from other countries that have really changed in a matter of 4 or 5 years, you will get empowered. You will get stronger as a far-right party, as a Nazi party. So yes, for me, was a crucial, the effect of the people and the movement was crucial.
And it made it maybe easier because Chrissi Avgi was working in this really open way.
Yeah.
Like lots the of symbols, the Hitler Gruß,
Their chants and their hymns and what the fuck ever, their marches.
Yeah. They didn't try to be somehow in a smart
new... You need to... I don't know if you have seen any videos and things like that to understand the way they were moving in the neighborhoods.
Yeah, I've seen, but maybe we can add some links as well.
We have published lots of stuff in YouTube. The battalions that were actually marching through the streets was, you know, like being in another era, in a way. This is... the center of Piraeus, besides the train station. They were doing that each week. They were going there, marching there, and they were singing the national anthem. They were going to the mountains, training and shooting and doing shit like that, trying to be very militarized. Now they're singing a special forces chant.
But it's like US. Melody.
Yeah, it's the same stuff, because our army actually was US trained, especially after the Second World War.
Okay.
The Truman Doctrine. Look how they were marching through the neighborhoods.
Like a special force.
Three or four women in front to, you know, pass out newspapers and shit like that. But these guys were behind and marching and chanting through the streets. Inside, this is a very renowned video because he's the guy that called all the other guys that sent an SMS from the office the night that Fissas was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He was the leader of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So in this video, he actually organizes a same action. And they were talking and saying that we're going to go to that fair. It was a religious fair outside a church in Nikea. And we're going to go there as plain citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And if something happens, there's going to be a team of us here ready. And they're going to come, they're going to have everything on them. And whoever moves gets slaughtered. And he said it, like, you know, word by word. And these videos were found inside their hard disks, their laptops, their mobile phones and so on. They are part of the case file in the trial. So, yeah. They were doing that day by day, week by week. That's from inside the courtroom. Sons of bitches, anarchists.
Okay. But it's like they are always there to support them? Or?
No. After that, they just stopped coming.
Okay.
Nobody stopped them from getting in. Look at the car. He's one of the security of the Führer. He's a boxer. And these are the anarchists with the SWAT teams. Look at that. They are hitting them, and yeah. And now they are chanting blood, honor, Golden Dawn.
Yeah, it's quite obvious what the police is doing, huh?
Of course it is. It was yeah, almost two and a half years after the beginning of the trial. So yeah, we published lots of videos. You can see lots of stuff. I'm sure you will not be able to understand everything, but we made a documentary some years ago called Golden Dawn, A Personal Affair. Greek French journalist that was following Golden Dawn for 3 or 4 years. And we made a full feature documentary that you can see freely. It's inside their offices, one of the Lopa chapters.
But it was like undercover.
She was like, you know, I'm making a report, whatever. Uh-huh. Because she worked with Arte, she works with Belgian and French networks. Mm-hmm. And she was with them, like, you know, I want to show what you do and what you say and what you're thinking and shit like that. The thing we wanted to show is that actually it's a bit of a Hannah Arendt thing. Golden Dawners and Nazis in general are not like, you know, the beasts that you expect them to be. They're people, next door neighbors. And that's something that we need to keep in mind. So yeah, you can also watch that. You know, have an idea of the inner works of Golden Dawn.
And to come back to the trial, how was it possible? I mean, was the Pablo Sfisa murder?
We have 4 major cases and more than 35 that are combined. I think that it was a combination of elements. First of all, there was huge pressure from society after Pablo Sfisa's murder. Because one part of society knew very well what's going on with the Golden Dawners. The second thing was that the Pablo Sfisa's murder was actually the catalyst that made the police forces to take a step back and to think that now we cannot cover this up. We cannot do stuff to covering it up because we're going to have riots in the streets. We had for 1 or 2 days. And they thought that we need to let it go. The third thing was that some investigators from the judicial body, the two women investigators that were that put the case together, were you know, they had decided that case needs to move on as a whole and not as separate cases. It should move on as a case of a criminal organization because we have lots of incidents that need to be combined, and that was crucial. And in that part, a huge part was played by the people of the civil action, because they also had a very good archive and files of Golden Dawners doing stuff and actions and crimes and so on. And they also contributed to the case file evidence. I think that this combination of elements made the trial possible, actually. It had to be like that. It couldn't be by, you know, it couldn't be affected by only one.
Yeah, that's interesting that a lot of the information is not coming from kind of a secret service of us who infiltrated them, but from the anti-fascist movement.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same thing. If you have followed the NSU trial, it's the same thing. Because, first of all, it was by luck, by accident. Because if that robbery that we were trying to pull was, you know, went well as all the others that they had done in the past, the two guys that killed themselves, they wouldn't have killed themselves, and Beata Tsipras would not be accused. And the NSU actions would never be revealed.
Mm.
So it was by accident.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, you could see the way and you could understand the way that the various secret services in the various states of Germany were not at all helpful.
Tried to hide.
Yes.
And tried
yes.
to hide.
Yes, yes. Because I was talking with Antonia von Behrens some days ago because they were in Greece. And she's one of the, she was one of the councils of the civil action, and she was telling me that we know that we have more than 40 people in the CAPS and the various different secret services that in one way or another helped the NSU do stuff, either by providing them information, either by providing them cover or guns or whatever. And the decision of the court was, you know, it was frustrating for them.
Yeah.
It's always part of the people that are pursuing the cases, not the authorities.
So the trial began?
Oh, no.
Or at first they arrested?
Yes, they were arrested.
A bunch of Chrissy
Avnitis. 8-10 days after Fissas was murdered. The first arrests were, yeah, 8-10 days after Fissas was murdered. Besides the perpetrator, besides Roupakias,
mm-hmm.
who was arrested by in the same night. Because Fissas, when Roupakias stabbed Fissas, Fissas said he stabbed me. And that's how CAPS arrested him. Yes, and the CAPS were present. That's what the forensic video also actually showed. Yes. Mm-hmm. It explained what the witnesses saw that night, because we had two certain witnesses, they were university students, and they were out for a coffee and so on. They were returning back home, and they said that the CAPS were there, that there were two attacks, that afterwards Roupakias came and so on. And up to, you know, until the time that the video was shown inside the courtroom and then was published, you know, everybody was saying, like, what they are talking about. And the Golden Donors were saying, like, oh, they're liars and blah, blah. And when the videos came out and when it was shown in the court, you know, everybody was like, mm-hmm, okay. Yeah, I forget the questions lots of times.
Yeah. How the trial started.
Yeah, how the trial
started. Let's give a frame to the trial.
Yeah.
What happened the last 3.5 years now?
Well, we began the first 2 or 3 months with lots of objections and various technical and judicial things from the two sides, the defense and the civil action. But the trial tried to, they started examining witnesses and tried to have a rhythm like 8-10 trial days per month. There was a huge period, like 4 to 6 months, that we didn't have any proceedings because there was a strike from lawyers. But there's a catch there in terms of one part of the civil action asked for permission from their union to go on with the trial, and they got it. But the Golden Dawn defense never asked for a permission to go on with the trial during the strike. You know, we could have 6 more months of proceedings done if the defense had done the same thing as the civil action to ask for permission for the trial to move on.
Mm-hmm.
A second element that we need to take under consideration is that we have a rule in the Greek judicial system that we cannot record or video the proceedings unless all of the actors agree. We have 3 actors, civil action, defense, and the court. When the time for the decision came, the defense denied recording and video of the proceedings. So it's a full contradiction with what they were saying prior to the trial, because they were saying prior to the trial that it's a mistrial, it's a whole setup, and we need to go to trial to show people that we are being accused falsely. And when there was that chance for them to show to the people that they are being accused falsely and so on, they denied it. And after the strike, the proceedings moved on. We saw something like 150 witnesses examined. Witnesses mostly for the four big cases and witnesses from other cases that have been combined to the case file. So we listened to lots of people, victims, witnesses that were in attacks. And after that, we started reading, the court started reading and viewing evidence from the case file, evidence that came from newspapers, the defendant's hard disks and USBs and mobile phones and so on, statements from them, interviews, photographs, lots of stuff for months. And after that, all these evidence were brought to the court. We reached the point that the defendants now bring their own evidence in their defense, because we have one list of evidence that was combined in the beginning of the trial, and after that is being shown and read and so on, we have the two parts bringing their own evidence that were not part of the case file. That happened for the civil action. And now the defendants actually are bringing for each one of them is bringing through their lawyers things that they estimate that they are evidence of their innocence. And what is that? A big part of that is their speeches in parliament. They have brought their speeches in parliament through these 5 years as an element of innocence, in terms of the line, the difference line is that how can these people have that parliamentary work and be a part or administrating a criminal organization. But there is also a catch there, a very interesting thing, that a big part of that parliamentary questions and speeches and so on are about the Golden Dawn's target, like migrants, leftists, anarchists. All these that I mentioned were and still are targets for Golden Dawn, and they have lots of incidents and attacks and, you know, crimes concerning these groups of people. So they, in one way, their own defense and their own defensive evidence are pointing to their targets and their, you know, their enemies that they were trying to suppress with their violence. So it's one thing also to that you know, has created some questions like, what the fuck are they doing? Are they trying to actually create more burden in an already very heavy case? It's like sometimes they don't understand what the fuck they are bringing in the courtroom, or their behavior. Lots of times they have attacked in words, and sometimes they have also tried to use more than words. They have attacked councils from the Communist Party. And they have that you know, that notion that you say that we are fascist, but you have done and Stalin has killed and shit like that. You know, what about this 101? And they do that inside the courtroom. You know, you have a case that says that they have national socialistic motive, actually, to go and attack and make crimes that are violent and racist and so on. And they actually exhibit that kind of behavior inside the courtroom, not the defendant, but their counsels. Because we have another element here. A part of the counsels, the defense attorneys, are being paid by the Greek parliament. Why? Yeah. Because they are when the party got into the parliament, he got some scientific advisors. When a party goes into the parliament in Greece, has the right to have some scientific advisors for their MPs. Mm-hmm. Okay, and a big part of that of these scientific advisors are actually their lawyers. So they are getting paid as scientific advisors of the MPs of the party from the Greek parliament. And they support them in the trial, and they are their counsels. Yeah, it's the democratic oxymoron. Even worse, the civil action councils are not getting paid. Who could pay them? Magda Fissa or the Egyptian fishermen? Okay, we can talk about the Communist Party a bit because yes, they have real estate. They are the Communist Party, whatever that means.
It's like they come from the civil society. The other side, the Chrysi Avgi side, is paid from the state.
Yeah, so yeah, and it's legal.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, whatever that is, and that's a question. There was a crucial point after the examination of the Fissa's murder, when the next case started to be examined, that the court understood what's going on. Because in the beginning, the first months, the court, the judge, she was very, like, you know, very distant and very strict with the civil action and so on. But after the examination of Fissa's case, we understood a bit of a shift, a bit of all these things that are being described in the case file might not be so bullshit after all. The mentality of the Greek judge, that he's mostly right to far right, pro-religion, God and shit like that, family, and he has that mentality, the right mentality, the right-wing mentality. But after the Fissa case, and when the migrants came to talk, the victims and so on, when other witnesses from other cases, mostly with migrants, came to talk also, she began to think the not so bullshit case file narrative in her head. I believe that we have lots of evidence now, and we have lots of witnesses, and we have a case file that's been fully supported by the evidence. And it would be a scandal not to have a conviction for a criminal organization.
Mm-hmm. When will this be? Like
mid-2019. We have stepped up a pace a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because we used to have 10 trial days per month. And now the court has already announced for December and... She put more trial days on November, and for December we have something like 10 trial days in 20 working days. The pace is going to increase. On the opposite side, there's some voices that say that Golden Dawn brings shitty defense material on paper, on purpose.
To survive the elections,
yeah.
Which will be in 2019.
Yeah, we're going to have triple elections. We're going to have the municipal and the peripheral, the European and the municipal.
If the decision is made that Chrysi Avgi is a criminal group, what would happen? I mean, somehow they would still stay in politics, just with another name. Maybe they found a new.
We need to look a bit on the procedures that have to take place after that, because we have appeal. They're going to go to the higher court, and all that cycle must close in order for the state to make new legislation or constitutional legislation and constitutional changes and so on for the Golden Dawn as a party and as a national socialist established by the court organization to be expelled in a way from the political system.
Mm.
So that's one step that even with the court decision is not going to be immediately taken. In theory, of course, we're going to have a huge blow in Golden Dawn's organization and image and appearance and so on. We can see these last weeks and months lots of far-right persons and personalities trying to take advantage of the situation that's coming, and they know that. They know that there is a situation coming that will cost Golden Dawn lots of voters. And they are creating new groups and new parties and new organizations to absorb this. Four major far-right players in Greece are getting together and are going to go together in elections. they're fucking stupid traditional far-right thugs, actually. They don't have a political platform. One of them is the cousin of the now Minister of Defense and the co-governor, Kamenos.
Yeah, the trial will take a lot of votes from them. Is the trial, is it covered by media?
I think now we cannot actually see the impact now. The impact we are going to see after after the defendant's statement.
What are you thinking about the election? How many votes they will take?
Well, depends. I think that we have lots of chances to influence that. But we need to do stuff. I think that they're not going to lose a lot. They're going to be something like 4 to 6%. They had 7 point something, and their poll... their polls for the past 3 years have not shown that they're going to lose a lot. Even though they don't have the power, they don't have the money now to, you know, promote themselves and to go to market themselves in the way they did. They don't have the media because the media, you know, they're a bit distant now due to the trial.
And they have people in prison?
No, not anymore. No one.
None of them.
Yes, okay. None of them. They have all the people that were in prison in the beginning, they reached their maximum months of pre-trial imprisonment according to the Greek laws. So they're in their houses, they have some restraining orders, and you know, you need to be present in the local police station once a month. You cannot leave Greece and shit like that, but they're free. Golden Dawn Watch is going to keep on reporting whatever goes on. And with the same way, with the same credible stance, and with the same distance. And that's the way it should be. But we have an anti-fascist movement that it's formed from various forces that come from the anti-authoritarian spectrum and reach the far left spectrum. For me, there's a huge chance to copy strategies like Trump's and like the Brexiters. And I'm talking about Cambridge Analytica, I'm talking about digital political work and so on. And for me, we need to segment the target audiences that Golden Dawn is going to talk with or try to talk with, understand what their needs and thoughts are, and gather raise some funds to go out with a counter campaign prior to elections, mostly in a digital level. For me, that would be a huge, it's a very needed effort, and that would be a huge attempt. And I think it's going to be successful in a big part if we do it right. A huge attempt to influence things in a higher level. Because if we understand why and how these people are going to vote for Golden Dawn, we might create counter narratives and counter campaigns to reach them in their everyday life through social media and so on. That's what happened with Trump. That's what happened with the first Brexit. They created a huge marketing effort with various and different messages delivered to different target audiences. In the same way, the UKIP and all that Nigel Farage stupidity managed to win Brexit referendum with the same company, Cambridge Analytica. They made a segmentation, they put a huge budget on social media and so on. We have a chance, to conclude, we have a chance to copy these procedures in a small scale, of course, but in a more targeted way. We don't want millions of voters. We don't want to, you know, to shift a huge electorate. We just need to shift 100 to 100,000 people. For me, it's a huge chance to do that in these elections. Desperate times need desperate measures and so on. And we need to, you know, take the tools that other people and corporations and so on are using to sell to us and to create all that bubble of consuming and being through consuming and so on. We can take all that and put it in a good use. That's my take on the situation in general. It's like, you know, sometimes they say that capitalists are going to sell us the rope that we're going to hunt them with. But we need to manage and understand how to make the fucking knot. I don't give a fuck who you're going to go with. Don't go with them. Why? Because we need to find the wise. And the wise that actually connect with certain target audiences. Because different target audiences have different wise. It's not one way for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
What's the thing it's going to, you know, intrigue someone to think about not voting for Golden Dawn? And he's going to take a decision affected by your message. Not like, you know, come with us, we are better. No.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, vote for the table. Vote for the goat of your neighbor, whatever, fuck ever. I don't give a fuck. Don't vote for Golden Dawn.
No. Temetinitus.org